This is Greg Kelly, and thank you very, very much. The podcast is kind of taking off, just like the TV show. See, this is pretty wild. We're being quoted all over the place. Mainstream media are listening. They're hanging on my every word. And so if you are hanging on my every word and you're listening to this, let me be quite clear. This is not over. And also, the questions that we're raising, the issues that we are exploring, none of it undermines democracy, okay? What the president is doing is well within the framework of democracy. Lawsuits, by the way, are part of our democratic system, okay? And negotiating, jockeying before the Electoral College meets, that's also within the framework of the Constitution, okay? Everybody should lighten up. I mean, my goodness gracious. I think a reality check is needed by a lot of those who are losing their minds right now. So, what else did I want to tell you about? Number one, thank you very, very much. The emails, all that stuff. Great to hear from you. Really appreciate that you're subscribing. By the way, if you want to advertise, let us know. Put it big in the subject line, okay? Potential advertiser. And we'll be sure to get back to you. Is anyone losing friends over this situation with the recount and whatever the hell you want to call it? I do notice that some of my left-leaning friends I'm hearing from not as often, and some have chided me rather aggressively, and that's fine. I have never really done that with any of them. Plenty of people disagree with me that I like. Plenty of public figures out there who are on the other side that I might even kind of like. But anyway, that's the way things are. And that's okay. My job is not to straighten out the world or straighten out any one individual for thinking a certain way. You know, I heard that actually first from Joel Osteen, you know, the minister, the pastor, who I used to listen to quite a bit. I still like him, but I'm not listening to him as much as I used to. I read several of his books, and he was talking about some of the critics that he had. And, you know, it's funny. Some guy apparently like wrote a book about him, and he didn't even know the author's name. I think there's something really beautiful about that. But someone approached him and said this, that, and the other, and his wife had watched the whole exchange, and the wife noticed that the man was wrong and, you know, was giving Joel a hard time about something that the individual didn't know anything about, and they walked off, and Victoria, his wife, was like, honey, why didn't you tell him, you know, why didn't you tell him off? Why didn't you set him straight? And Joel said, you know, my job is not to straighten everybody out. And that stayed with me. You know, my job is not to straighten everybody out. To each his own sometimes. And you kind of accept that your role in life is not to straighten out everybody who you think might be wrong. By the way, they might be right. You got to consider that. So anyway, I kind of like that. By the way, I now listen and read, well, I listen to Charles Stanley, his podcast, Dr. Charles Stanley. He's a minister in Atlanta, and I highly recommend his the edition of the Bible, Charles Stanley Life Principles Bible. If you're like me, and every time you picked up the Bible over the years, and you were like, what does this all mean? I'll get back to it later. There's footnotes and essays and little explainers that have helped me get through the book. And getting through that book is a wonderful, wonderful experience. And you never really quite get through it because it's so big. And yes, complex and interesting and different. It's kind of, from what I'm told, it's designed by God to bring us back, to keep us coming back. And you can never master that book, no matter how long you try. You just got to keep learning and keep growing. Faith came up a little bit in this conversation that I'm about to have with Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, United States Marine Corps retired. Oliver North, wow. A superhero of mine. I was in high school when he became worldwide famous. It was hard to explain the level of fame he had for probably 2 or 3 years, and he's still famous, but we're talking household name famous. We're talking like Donald Trump. Everybody was talking about this guy all the time and wondering about him and what did he do and what is he going to do and what's he all about. And the Iran-Contra affair was one thing, but Oliver North became bigger than all of it. I'll summarize real quick. He was a National Security Council official, a mid-level Marine Corps active duty officer, Vietnam veteran, by the way, graduate of the United States Naval Academy. And he was accused of illegally arranging for money to go to the Nicaraguan Contras at a time when that was technically against the law. So he ultimately established his innocence, and he did it in the most spectacular way before the American people in Congress in live televised hearings. At the time, we hadn't seen anything like those since Watergate. Now, you see them all the time, and they're almost meaningless. You know, the silly Mueller investigation and the impeachment, you know, they tried to make it as significant as these previous events, but no, everybody's doing a million different things. But back then, in 1987, the entire world was mesmerized by this, and there were only 3 channels and 4 channels, whatever, and everybody watched. And it was such a huge deal. So Oliver North made a very positive impression on me as he spoke up for freedom and democracy, and had a very strong anti-communist message, and also made it quite clear that he was doing his duty and he was doing it within the law, and he was authorized by superiors. And anyway, he impressed a lot of people, and he went on to a great career as a broadcaster, as an author, as a historian. And in the early 2000s, I got to know him. In 2003, I was a correspondent for the Fox News Channel, brand new. I was hired in November of 2002. By the end of January, by January, I was in Kuwait, waiting for the start of the Iraq War, which I did not think would actually come. I was skeptical that it was necessary. I thought this thing was going to be called off, and I really kind of wanted to just go home. I was not really enthusiastic about being in Kuwait. I felt like it was a diversion, quite frankly, in my own life, and there were things that I wanted to get to as a new correspondent for the Fox News Channel, and I had already been to Kuwait, and I had already flown over Iraq as a Marine Corps officer, and I just wasn't as excited as you think one would be in that position because of what I had been through. Anyway, so guess who was my colleague in Kuwait? Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North. It was very interesting and so cool to have this guy who was a hero of mine, is a hero of mine, to be suddenly a colleague of mine. I mean, yes, he was famous. Yes, he was a historian. Yes, he had his own special show on Fox News. But for those weeks we were together in Kuwait, you know, he was another correspondent and he was a peer of mine. And he was, again, very, very cool. He was nice. He was interesting. He was open. One of the very few people who I've seen who's truly the same on camera as he is off camera. And also very, very smart. I try to bring this up in the conversation you're about to hear, and I mess it up a little bit in asking him. But I do remember talking to him about it at the time. Like, he was giving all of us kind of a detailed education on military operations, how the invasion might go, what kind of equipment they would emphasize, wouldn't emphasize, and strategy and tactics. And it was cutting edge stuff. This is a guy who had just, it looked like, walked out of CENTCOM and not gotten some press brief, but had really been educated and brought up to speed and knew just everything that was going on, was an expert. Now you could say, well, sure, he's a Marine officer career. Why wouldn't he know all that stuff? Well, it's very easy to just rely on what you knew way back when and try to get by on that. This guy was just, so well-versed in kind of cutting-edge military affairs, far more than I was, and I had only been in the military. I had been in the military just 3 years prior, and I promptly just dove into civilian life. Anyway, we were also, it was very interesting, we found ourselves kind of unliked by the same supervisor. There was some guy there who was running the operation for Fox, and he took a brutal and obvious disliking to me. It was kind of comical. I mean, everybody has that in life, sooner or later, a boss who just hates you for no real good reason. Maybe he thinks he had his reasons, I don't know. But this guy was hated me, and he deeply resented Oliver North. And we were like the two misfits at what company to be in, you know? I remember Ollie, was like the second, third night, he comes to me and he goes, "Hey, Greg, we're going to go see some Marines in the field tomorrow. Do you want to come?" And I'm like, "Gosh, how do you, of course, you know, Oliver North, how do you say no to seeing Marines in the field tomorrow?" And he said, I said, "Yeah, of course, yeah, yes." I said, what time? And he said, 6 o'clock. I said, in the morning? Ollie laughed like crazy. He just thought that was the funniest thing. At a typical pilot kind of reaction, 6 o'clock in the morning, who wants to do that? And Ollie, you know, an infantry officer, very hardcore, these guys, getting up in the morning. Anyway, it was very funny. And so we go out to the field the next day, Ollie, me, one or two others, and we're having a great time meeting Marines. I'm with Oliver North. This is a great, great thing. And we're learning stuff. And then I guess it was maybe 11 o'clock or so. We had this daily meeting back at Fox News Kuwait Bureau, you know, which was just down the hall from our hotel room with this guy who, I wish I could remember his name. Anyway, he gets a call, the phone rings, and it's from him. You know, the number comes up, and like, "Oh my God, shoot, we forgot about the meeting." And we're passing the phone around. I don't want to answer it. So we give it to Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, and he knows the deal. And he says, this is Oliver North. How much trouble am I in?" Or at, and he's like, He looks at me and he says, "He wants to talk to you." So whoever this guy was, smart enough to not yell at Oliver North, but that he proceeded to do so to me. And I'm like, okay. And he was mad. And after I put down the phone, and North turns to me, he goes, "Was he pissed?" And again, just imagine, your boyhood hero, and you're in detention with him, or potentially going to detention. Great spot to be in, by the way. Great spot. All right. So Ollie and I talk, as I say, well, you know this by now. Look, I guy's great. He only had a half hour to speak to me because today is the Army-Navy game. He's having people coming over. So quite frankly, we barely scratched the surface. And so this is kind of a little bit all over the place, and we will have another conversation hopefully next week or the week after, and this will be continued. So I hope you, that's where I'm coming from in this conversation, and here it is. Before I start that, go to olivernorth.com. He's got a lot of things going on. olivernorth.com, it's all there. You know, he's the founder of the Freedom Alliance. He has his own podcast, and there are a couple of books that he's involved in. One, he's not an author of, but I think he helped put it together. It's called America's Number One Adversary and What We Must Do About It. It's about China, and it's by John Poindexter, Robert McFarland, and Richard Levine. Now, Poindexter and McFarland are two former national security advisors under President Reagan. And I know both of them worked with Oliver North back then in the 1980s, and he's still friends with both of them. Admiral Poindexter, and I think Robert McFarlane was a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps, also a Naval Academy graduate, if I'm not mistaken. But that is one book, and that is he came on the show a couple of days ago, and we talked about that for a bit. It seems fascinating. It's available wherever books are sold for not a lot of money, actually. Also, Veterans Lament, Is This the America Our Heroes Fought For?, is available everywhere. And again, very, very grateful. He's a very, very interesting, extraordinary man. Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, United States Marine Corps, retired. So going back to, I guess it was this winter of 86, this is my recollection, the dates might be off, when you were mentioned at the White House podium that you had been relieved, and there was a great deal of sudden controversy and attention for you. Obviously, the next months were very eventful, and your testimony before the committee there in Congress, and you became incredibly famous. I remember vividly talking about you, wondering about you, and everybody was talking about you. I just would like to know, what was it like for you to go, you know, you were essentially an anonymous 05 in the Marine Corps, and you go from a guy, you know, who probably went to the PX and the commissary and had a, he had a very interesting job, but the outside world didn't know about that, and suddenly you're the most famous man in America. What, was that discombobulating? Was that just difficult to cope with? Was it surreal? How would you character, what was that like?
Well, from that, my recollection is it was the Tuesday before Thanksgiving and in 1986. And everything went according to plan. Admiral Poindexter and I were reassigned from the National Security Council staff. He was National Security Advisor. I was Deputy Director for Political Military Affairs. That was the official title. And all of a sudden, our names are all over the place, and we've been reassigned out of the White House. All that was part of the plan. We had set this all up as a project that was absolutely necessary, and we never expended any U.S. government money on it. So the charge was that we had violated the Bolin Amendment. Most people in America did not know what the Bolin Amendment was. It was a paragraph in the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA. And it essentially said no funds made available by this act may be used or have the effect of providing direct or indirect support for paramilitary or military operations against the Sandinista government in Nicaragua. That's what it said. I think that's almost a direct quote. Well, that didn't mean a heck of a lot to anybody, but what it did mean to me is that immediately we had the National Press Corps gathered on our front lawn. We had a nice, quiet little home in Great Falls, Virginia. We had a fence out. We had the security system installed by General Dick Secord, because I was on my way to Tehran when the threats first started coming in. And the threats were aimed at 11 of us, or 12 of us, the National Security Advisor, the Director of Central Intelligence, et cetera, et cetera. Well, all of them had their own security. I didn't. And my name is on that list of targets for the Islamic Jihad, the Abu Nidal's organization that was working for the Libyans at the time. And because I was on my way, or maybe was already in Tehran, trying to bring American hostages back from Beirut, Dick Secord installed a security system, which worked for keeping the press out and for, you know, countering the threat of the terror attack that was aimed at and eventually actually carried out, unsuccessfully for them, thankfully. So we ended up with the National Press Corps starting then all the way through the summer of 87. Every single day, they were there on Saturdays, Sundays, every religious holiday. They were there for, you know, New Year's, Tet, Hanukkah.
Wait, were they there? Were they there for New? I want you to think back. New Year's morning, were they there for that?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, they were. I know what you're aiming at. But yeah. I mean, obviously, some guys were. It wasn't that they were just there on New Year's morning. They were there 24/7, all through the middle of winter. I mean, I almost felt sorry for some of them, but you know, at the end of the day, there was no sorrow expressed in reality for me.
So just on a personal level, though, I mean, like, and I know, by the way, you behaved honorably every step of the way, and the record reflects that, and there's no anybody who knows about this case and those who don't, you know, you did the right thing. But I am curious again, like, just even in the Marine Corps, suddenly you're more famous than the commandant. You're more famous than the commandant of the Marine Corps. Everybody knows Oliver North. Nobody knows who, I think it was General Kelly at the time, maybe, I'm not sure, General Gray. So, like, what was that? Did that, that must have complicated your life. You're back working at headquarters Marine Corps. You're walking down the hall. You're in an office as Oliver North, the most famous Marine who basically ever lived, maybe Chesty Puller or something like that. What was that like? Did that, that must have, there must have been some nice things and there must have been some awful things associated with that.
Well, look, I actually retired from the Marine Corps on some days of your life you don't forget. It was March of 1987, because I was indicted. The special prosecutor brought charges against me in the summer of, I'm sorry, it was March of 1988, right after the terror threat. And so we ended up with 37 federal agents, not all on duty at the same time. I mean, there are three sections of the watch and 37 Naval Intelligence Service special agents protected Betsy and our kids and me, living on the property. They put in a double-wide trailer in this little two-acre plot there in Great Falls, Virginia. And the press made this story what it was. I mean, I would pull out Brendan Sullivan, who was my very famous attorney who represented me. He's the guy that sat next to me in those hearings.
Right, said he's not the potted plant. That was the big line.
I'm the lawyer here. I'm not a potted plant. By the time we got back to the office that day, his office floor, desk, chairs, every cabinet are full of, guess what, potted plants from his colleagues and those he argued against and argued for and all that. It was incredible. Anyway, compared to being shot at and hit, compared to having Marines die in your arms, compared to going into combat with guys who don't come out and survive it, this was nothing. The fact is, I knew these guys were, even the press that was out there, it's, somebody said to me at one point during the hearings, it's July of 1987, and you're not even breaking out of sweat. I said, well, compared to some other things I've been through, this is nothing. And it's absolutely true. Look, I revered the Marines that I got to serve with. You're a U.S. Marine. You know what it was like to fly the AV-8. You know what it was like to have Marines who did things for you that they didn't have to do. I mean, we both had those kinds of experiences. And my sense is most Marine officers and most of the senior enlisted guys looked at it and said, yeah, he's a tough guy, but he's one of us. And so, with very few exceptions inside the Marine Corps, my friendships remained the same. There were some extraordinary, unprecedented, and unfavorable events that happened, but I'm not the kind of guy that sits around and whines about it. And you know, I was absolutely sure that at the end of the day, all this was going to shake out and I'd be just fine. And it turned out that's exactly what happened.
I have heard that sentiment a lot from Marines, from soldiers, from pilots in the Air Force that, you know, whatever personal challenge they're going through, this is nothing compared to landing on an aircraft carrier or you know, being in Fallujah. You know, I've heard that, and generally speaking, it's self-talk. It's kind of like trying to psych themselves up. I heard Martha McSally, who I like a lot, say that, you know, this is nothing compared to flying a mission. But I always thought it was kind of, there was something vaguely boastful about it and not entirely authentic. But hearing what you just said and knowing and remembering vividly how you performed in those Senate hearings, you're being absolutely authentic. And that was conveyed. You had an incredible confidence that I think came from just what you say, and that you're filling in some blanks for me, because I really wondered, and you know what I'm talking about. I mean, and America was just dazzled by, who is this man with this charisma, and he's relaxed, and he's, you know, he's not intimidated by anyone. It was something else. And I'd actually like to ask, Was your faith a bit, is faith a big part of your life? And if, forgive me, by the way, I should say, if there's anything you don't want to talk about, let me know and we'll just take it out. But I'm just curious, was that a, did that help get you through?
Sure. I mean, look at, I've got 18 grandkids. Two of them are in college, right? And the youngest is 5 months old. So I'm going to be around young people for a long time to come, Lord willing. I know where I'm going. I know why I'm going there. And my goal in life today, a little different than it was back in those days, is to show those 18, not just talk about it, but show those 18 grandkids what a follower of Jesus Christ does, how they behave, not just the words that they utter, but the actions that they take. So my goal is to have these kids eventually, and I don't need them to see the magazine covers. I've got hanging up on my wall, I'm in my home office, which is up over the garage, right? My wonderful old Boykin Spaniel's sleeping right beside my feet. I'm looking up at it. I've got the picture of the front of Life magazine, the August edition in 1987. And on the cover is a picture. It was taken at the Secretary of the Navy's house on the 4th of July, I think it was. And it's Betsy and me. And one of the grandsons is standing here looking at the picture. And he realizes, I don't know if he'd ever noticed before, but he says, that's you and Nan, which is what the grandkids call my wife, their grandmother. And he says to me, looking at the picture, this is the way to put it, Nan was a beautiful woman. And I looked at him and I said, let me just tell you something, son. If you ever use the past tense describing my wife's beautiful face, you ever use the past tense again, she will take you and write you out of her will. Huh. The kids, I try to make sure that our kids get to see in me, not just a guy sitting at a desk answering questions from, you know, quite frankly, rumps up there in the raised dais, where all the Roman emperors were sitting, right? And there's this young Marine and his lawyer sitting there at this cloth cover table. That's not nearly as important to me as me showing day in and day out how a follower of Jesus Christ behaves, right? And so I try not to use profane language. I try not to do stupid things. But you and I are human beings, and so is everybody who's listening to this podcast. We're always going to screw things up. And so when I say I know where I'm going and I know why I'm going there, it's because of the commitment I made at the age of 35 to Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior, right? Ours is the only, Christianity is the only religion in which you don't have to do a thing to be saved. As we know in Islam, you're guaranteed a seat at the table, if that's what it is, or the seat with 72 Virginians, whatever it is. Right? You have to commit an act. In Christianity, all you have to do is make a decision. Romans 10:9. At the end of my days, here's the things I want them to remember. Romans 10:9, Paul's letter to the church in Rome, probably from prison. Okay? And he writes, if you confess with your lips that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart, you will be saved. Okay? Now, I'm absolutely convinced that's the truth, right? So at the end of my days, instead of putting all the medals and the wars and all the stuff that you and I did as Marines on the back of that gravestone, I've got a spot picked out at Arlington, right? Unless they change the rules, that's where they're going to plant me and plant Betsy with me at the same time. Well, not the same time, in the same place. And I want on the back of it something else from Paul. Paul writes probably his last letter, and he's writing to Timothy, who's one of his proteges. And he writes to Timothy in his second letter some words that are really important to me. And I want, on the back of it, paraphrasing that verse from 2 Timothy. He showed us how to fight the good fight, how to finish the race, and how to keep the faith. As you and I took an oath to the Constitution of the United States, and we raised our right hand and promised to be faithful to it, and we promised to defend it And what you and I promised to do is to the whole Constitution, not to some pantheon of gods or not to some political party, but faithful to that is a day-to-day experience for guys like you and me who served in the Marine Corps. And I want my grandkids to come to understand that, right? So that's a quote from Paul in his second letter to Timothy. He showed us how to fight the good fight, how to finish the race, and how to keep the faith.
Well, these are some very lucky grandkids to have such a figure and role model in there with access to. And, you know, just you mentioned my being a Marine. I wasn't a Marine in 1987. I was thinking very seriously about it. And a couple of things clinched it. I was thinking about it basically because my father had been a Marine and I was inspired by him. But a few things happened in the summer of 87. Full Metal Jacket came out, which I was mesmerized by, and I thought it was a fantastic movie, and your testimony. And then I remember you were on the, I've never seen this before. I know it's happened, but you were on the cover of Time magazine two consecutive weeks, which is an extremely unusual thing to happen. Anyway, and I just want to say to the folks who have not met you, obviously I met you like everybody else who's old enough to remember that summer. And then fast forward to 2003, the war is heating up. You and I meet in Kuwait. We're both working for Fox News. And you do have this way about you that makes total sense now. Mixture of confidence and charisma and... you're genuinely interested in other people, and now I know the source of it. I mean, now I know the source of it, that decision you made when you were 35 years old. You're also, unlike a lot of people who achieve fame and then, forgive me, well, make an industry out of some incident or, you know, when they were exposed and received a lot of attention, they kind of turn around and they cash in on that. You have kind of not only reinvented yourself, you stayed current on everything, military affairs. You did not atrophy, if that makes sense. And you and I talked about this in 2003, because you had been out of the Marine Corps for 15, 16 years at that point, yet you were a top flight expert on everything in military matters. You know what I'm talking about. That was an effort. You have to make that effort.
Well, first of all, I love to keep company with heroes. And you and I have done that for much of our lives. In my case, my very first hero that I knew was a hero was my dad. Very much like your situation. I mean, your dad is of course legendary in his own way. And between you and me and everybody else, listen, I sure as the dickens hope he runs for governor of the state of New York, because I think he'd do a great job. And anyway, look, my mom and dad met at a USO dance in 1941 in Fort Niagara. They got married in 1942. I was born in 1943 at Fort Sam Houston in Texas. And I got to tell you a quick story. One of the guys that we covered, you and I, as correspondents out there, was a U.S. Army colonel by the name of John Gronsky. And I saw John out there several times, because I would always try to go for Fox when I was going out to cover the war and doing the War Stories episodes about it, basically keeping a contemporary history of the war. And one of the guys that we covered was a fellow by the name of John Gronsky, brigade commander. And when he got promoted, this is about 4 years ago, to major general, 5 years ago, I went out and covered that, right? And that ceremony was being held at Fort Indiantown Gap up here in Pennsylvania. And so afterwards, I was invited, because I'd covered him so many times during the war, as a hero, right? And as at the reception, an older guy on a walker comes up to me and says, "You were born at Fort Sam Houston in October of 1943. I said, "Yes, sir, that's right. How do you know?" He said, "I delivered you." I said, "Really?" He said, "I'll tell you something else you don't know, Sonny. I was the only OBGYN in your father's regiment. I was the combat surgeon." And he said, "I delivered you. I examined your mother. And I'll tell you something else, Sonny, you don't know. You were sired," that's the word he used, "sired right here at Fort Indiantown Gap." And I said, "How do you know that, sir?" He said, "Very, very simple, son. The division left Fort Niagara in January and came here. In April, we deployed from here down to Fort Sam Houston to get ready to go to Europe, land in Normandy, as they eventually did. And he said, the division was here until from January to April. You were born in October. Do the math, son. Do the math. And of course, 9 months, it's probably sired right there in that Quonset hut down there. And you could see it at the bottom of the hill. So I look at those kinds of experiences and say, I would probably never have known what he told me had it not been for the fact that the Congress made me famous in the media, right? They stacked up outside our house every day. They terrified my little kids. I am still to this day angry about it. And at some point, I will get around to that wonderful phrase, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Right? That's from the Lord's Prayer. And I look at those words as, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive. And I'm not quite there yet with our colleagues in the media, because what they ended up doing is not just making me famous, but terrifying my kids. We had a 6-year-old and an 8-year-old who were badgered at school, who were badgered by the press. I mean, even on Christmas morning, our youngest, who was just 6, our youngest was going out against the rules. Never talk to these people. Don't ever go out there and talk to these folks. Don't ever say anything to them. And they'd be riding with me in the car, and you couldn't get out the gate because they'd line up across the driveway. And Brendan Sullivan's instructions were, don't talk to them and don't run over any of them. And so there were occasions when I broke the rule.
Well, you'd roll down the window and smile and kind of just say some small talk. I remember that. Gosh, right?
Yeah. One of them was holding up the – I had Sarah, the 8-year-old, right next to me. And they held up the Washington Compost from that morning, and the headline said something like, Oliver North is accused of stealing Nancy Reagan's shoes to help the cultures or something, BS title like that. And the guy said, have you seen this headline? And I said, yeah, I read 2 things every day. I read the Washington Compost and the Holy Bible, so I know what both sides are up to. Now get out of my way.
There's something I do want to touch on. When you ran for the Senate, here's another thing that impressed me. You ran for the Senate. You lost to Chuck Robb narrowly.
In a three-way race, I would point out.
Three-way race. There's a documentary that I recommend. I hope you like it. It's called A Perfect Candidate. I think you come out marvelously in the thing. But here's another thing that impressed me when I met you in 2003. A lot of times people who come that close to political power and don't achieve it, they're bitter. They're like, I don't know, it really, really throws them. And it's the second thing I asked you about. And you were totally fine with it. It was just like another adventure for you. Do you ever wonder, though, if you had won that race? I think it's safe to assume, or there's a very good chance you would have been president. Do you agree?
Well, I don't know, because one of the things I don't have is the gift of prophecy. So I try not to sit back and I tell young guys when I go out and give lectures on leadership, I get asked to get down to Quantico and talk to the graduating class at either OCS or the basic school, which you know about, okay? And so one of the things I tell them is learn from your own mistakes. We're all going to make them. Just don't repeat them, right? Make every mistake in the book once, but for heaven's sakes, don't make them twice. But number two, and I tell them, I said, by the way, this, another analogy. If you're sitting in your car or a cockpit, right, you've got a rear view mirror, right? And you've got a plexiglass or a glass front window. Which one's bigger? So learn from the things that went wrong. Don't play the game of shoulda, woulda, coulda, right? Because nobody wins that. But learn from the mistakes you made. And so I look at my rearview mirror just before I pull out on the road because I want to see if anybody's coming up behind me. But at the front of me is where the action's going to take place. So, yeah, did I learn something from the race? I sure did. I learned that one of the things you ought not to do is try to avoid the three-way races because somebody's not going to get all the votes that they deserve and that kind of thing. We're seeing the results of that, by the way, and right today, as we lead up to a January 5 is going to be the deciding vote for the U.S. Senate. So there's two races that are down there in Georgia. And so my experiences help guide me in the future. But ultimately, what's really guiding me is that decision I made way back in 1978. And by the way, that was because of the example set by a fellow Marine, right? It wasn't his words. He knows the words in that good book far better than I. He can tell you the specific verse that was on a card, right? If you look back at the footage, and please, folks, don't send me any more VHSs of the hearings. I don't even have a machine that I can play them on anymore. But sitting on the microphone stand is a card. It's handwritten. I've got it right here in my hand. It was handed to me as we came in that very first morning of the hearings. We're surrounded by a double cordon of, first of all, the special agents were part of the security detail for my family. Outside of that, Capitol Hill police officers. And you get to the big door as you walk into that hearing room, and there's a cluster gaggle. You know what I'm talking about, right? They can't all fit through the door at the same time, so people are jostling. And out of nowhere, a little old lady reaches through the double cordon from a cleared corridor. The whole corridor was cleared because the terror threat was very serious. I mean, they had tried to kill my wife and kids and me on February 11th, 1987. They set out to carry out the threat that they'd made way back in 1986. On that targeted list, here's the people we're going to kill because of what they did bombing Muammar Gaddafi. And we did, you know, and I'm not ashamed of that at all. So, at the end of the day, this lady hands him, Brendan sits, and you can see him admonishing me. You can't hear it for all the noise of the cameras and things like that and the cluster gaggle. But Brendan takes that card out of his hand, out of my hand, puts it in his pocket, and we sit down at the table, and he takes the card out and sets it on the microphone stand. Where the cameras are up, you know, behind all the lords, and, as I call them, the Roman emperors, there's cameras. Behind us, there's row after row of reporters, and way in the back of the room is the four or five seats that they've saved for the American public, right? And each time we get up to leave, Brendan would take the card out from the microphone stand, put it in his pocket, and we'd go out to the pee break or the lunch break or whatever it was. And each time we'd come back and set it down, they'd be up on the raised dais. They'd wait for Brendan to take the card out. And nobody could see what's on the card until the fourth or fifth day of this stuff. And at that point, one of the reporters gets to us before the security cordon closes around us and says, "What's on the card, Sullivan?" And Sullivan takes it out of his pocket, doesn't show the guy, and then puts it back in his card. He says, "What's on the card?" "The answers to the questions." Here's what's on the card. "They that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary." Isaiah 40:31. And he's right. Those are the answers. Now, the folks in the back couldn't see that. But that's the inspiration for being able to sit there and say, okay, this is stupid question number 45. In fact, what prompted Brendan to say what he did, one of the lawyers for the joint committee asked me a question. I don't even remember what it was. I said, you know, I really don't recall. And so he re-asked the same question. I said, well, just like I just answered, I don't recall. Then a third time, and at that point, Brendan says, "I object." And the chairman of this whole hoo-yah, Senator Inouye, says, "You can't object. He has to object," which is what prompted Brendan to come back and say, "He doesn't have to object. That's my job. I'm the lawyer here. I'm not a potted plant." I mean, that's the kind of stuff that my grandkids will know when they ask a question about it. I'll tell them those kinds of answers. Because I want them to understand, first of all, it's not just me. I had a great lawyer sitting right next to me. He's an inspiration to me that, hey, it's going to turn out okay. All you have to do is sit here, answer the questions, and tell the truth. And that's a lot easier than making up stories. And some of this stuff is extraordinary. I mean, one of the things that I did, Greg, way back at the start of all of this, I mean, I didn't start out being a director of covert operations. I started out to be the guy who was going to ensure the continuity of government. I had a committee that was formed and included people like Ed Teller, inventor of the hydrogen bomb, Herman Kahn, one of the great strategic analysts of all time from the Hudson Institute, Dolly Kriebel, Bill Baker from Bell Labs, all of which is designed to make sure that they could not decapitate the President of the United States. So if you notice on that bio that's out there in the public domain, that bio says from 1983 to 1986, North was the coordinator for the U.S. government's counterterrorism activities, which is true. But I actually got to the White House in 1981. I got there in July of 81. And so from July of 81 until mid-1983, I was in a truly secret job. I didn't have an alias passport yet. All that came later. But I got moved from that job because in 2 years, we'd done pretty much all that needed to be done. They laid out the process for it, got the funding for it. I actually met Tip O'Neill and Eddie Boland, his buddy from Massachusetts, for whom the Boland Amendment is named. I actually met them first in getting what we call the black money, very, very covert, billions of dollars, to ensure that the government of the United States could not be decapitated by a Soviet strike. And that was really super secret. And so very few people knew about the money. It was billions of dollars. And that's what I did. And then I got moved over to the counterterrorism job, which is what created all the controversy. So
now, Kurt, I know you've got people coming over. So yeah. I've got two things to run by you. Number one.
Tell everybody why.
You've got people coming over to watch the Army-Navy game. Of course, Oliver North is a famous graduate of the United States Naval Academy, and what a wonderful tradition it's going to be at the Mikey Stadium on West Point. And so I got to cut you loose, but two quick things.
Sure.
The story about the card in front of the microphone from Isaiah, I had not heard that story. I'll tell you, the last time I heard it, it's not the first time. I heard it from you in the audio version of Under Fire, which I listened to on a drive from Quantico to New York when I was on, it must have been Thanksgiving. It was the fall of 1991, without a doubt. That's in the book, correct?
It is.
And you read that book, by the way, the audio version. It's an amazing thing that Oliver North is talking to you. That was kind of a novelty at the time, audiobooks. And the other thing is this. If you don't mind, I can talk to your people, but I would love to talk to you some more on another occasion because there are a lot of things I'd like to get to, and if that's okay.
We will, because we're friends. And first of all, hey, folks, I know we had five of our correspondents covering the war. I was actually in Afghanistan leading up to the attack. Griff Jenkins became my cameraman. It was an extraordinary experience because I was pulled out of Afghanistan and sent in a kind of a chaotic way over to Kuwait so that I could join you and the other four correspondents that we had from Fox to cover the war. You are the only one of us who was actually wounded in that experience. And I can remember seeing it happen, not live, but you know, we would all watch each other's broadcasts every time we had a chance. And I can remember Griff going to me and says, hey, Greg Kelly just got wounded, because we got a call on the satellite phones from Fox saying, hey, you may have to move over and cover a different unit, which is, you were with 3rd ID. And I was with the 5th Marines, Joe Dunford, who turned out to do, actually Griff gave him his nickname, Fighting Joe Dunford. And you and I got to spend an extraordinary experience with some very brave soldiers, sailors, airmen, guardsmen, Marines in that whole experience. So it was a privilege to be with you. And yes, I'll be glad to do something more with you again in the future. But whenever we can, I mean that.
Thank you. Thank you very much, sir. Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, enjoy the game and to be continued. Thank you, sir.
I look forward to it. Semper Fi, Marine.
Semper Fi. Hoorah.
Hoorah.
Okay, sorry if that was a little bit jumbled at times, but hey, he's a hero of mine, and wow, very, very, it's cool for me to talk to him. I hope you enjoyed listening to that, and wow, his message of faith and how Jesus Christ changed everything and can change everything for you too. Has for me. Folks, check out olivernorth.com, the book, once again, that if he says it's an important book, I'm going to go out and get it It's America's Number One Adversary and What We Must Do About It Now by John Poindexter, Robert McFarland, and Richard Levine. Thank you very, very much. Did I mention OliverNorth.com? Yeah, check that out, everything he's doing. And by the way, it's a hard movie to get. A Perfect Candidate came out in 1996 about his 1994 run for the U.S. Senate. Extremely interesting, very entertaining. And I guess I looked online. It's only available, I think, on DVD. And, you know, a lot of folks don't even have DVD players anymore. I'm going to see where else it is and get back to you on that. Thank you for your support very, very much. If you want to continue the conversation, you can drop us a line at the podcast website or check out Twitter at Greg Kelly USA. And the show is on Newsmax, at Newsmax, at 7 p.m. East Coast time, all over. You know, do the adjustments accordingly. And thank you.